Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The theme of this series and all the education programs of our oncology CME group is the translation of clinical research advances into daily practice. I asked Dr. Ed Kim and Dr. Roy Herbst from MD Anderson Cancer Center to meet with four community-based medical oncologists who presented cases from their practices, and Dr. Kim and Dr. Herbst discussed how emerging clinical research data relates to these clinical situations. Doctors Stephen Grabelsky, Atif Hussain, Leonard Siegel, and Michael Troner presented these de-identified cases, beginning with Dr. Siegel.
This patient's a 60-year-old white female. She actually had a four-pack year smoking history, quit in 1974. She happened to get a screening thin-cut CT in July 2002 and was noted to have a 1.5 centimeter left upper lobe nodule. PET scan was hypermetabolic, only in the area concordant with the abnormality noted on CT scan. And in September 2002, she had a bronchoalveolar cell. She had negative bronchial and AP window lymph nodes on pathology.
Roy?
So it was pure bronchoalveolar cancer or adeno with BAC fecal?
At that point, they read it as pure BAC.
And her staging, she had no other sites of
No other disease. Sites of disease.
Well, you know, this is back in 2002, where adjuvant therapy at that point was not a standard of care. Certainly now we do look to adjuvant therapy in many patients. Though in this patient with a T1 lesion, BAC, I'm not even sure we would treat her with adjuvant therapy now. It's a continuum. Most of the studies look at patients at somewhat higher risk, you know, the 1Bs or higher. So, you know, would a patient like this get adjuvant therapy now? Probably not. I think that this is a low-risk situation, though, if it truly is BAC. But I think at this time, even in 2006, this is someone who probably, without any other sites of disease, I probably would just watch at this point.
I actually wanted to see her presented at this point to see what you thought about the idea of erlotinib at this point. I guess you could say she's an oligo smoker with a total of 4 pack years of usage that ended 30 years ago and bronchoalveolar.
It's a hard call. You know, certainly there are some studies that are ongoing now, a large study that's been done at several sites, MD Anderson, Vanderbilt, and Memorial, of course, leading this study, and several others that we'll hear about in the next year, looking now prospectively at erlotinib Tarceva in patients with BAC. Certainly anecdotally, we know that these are the patients that tend to respond a bit better. The survival numbers, at least from early in small cohorts, looked reasonably good. But should that now be used in the adjuvant setting, I think the data on that are still not fully there. I might use it later on if you now tell me the patient develops multiple other nodules. That might be a treatment to consider in the future, but I don't know if I'd use it in the absence of any measurable disease.
Ed, can you talk a little bit about your approach to adjuvant therapy and your thoughts about particularly this issue of T1 disease?
Yeah, so T1 itself, it becomes a little bit more confusing each year as we get more data sets in. The early data sets suggested that stage 1 tumors, perhaps the larger stage 1Bs, benefited from adjuvant chemotherapy. The smaller sort of T1 versions, maybe there were a mixed bag. Some of the studies that have been looked at anecdotally, especially the Japanese UFT data, suggest that maybe 2 centimeters is a cutoff point for their treatment of benefit. In this particular patient with a 1.5 centimeter T1 lesion, I agree with Roy in that we would not have given this woman any adjuvant therapy this time. We probably would have considered her, if there was a clinical trial open, that there are trials now looking at giving adjuvant maintenance therapy with these biological agents. The only thing I'm a little bit bothered with is that although we do have a PET scan, there was a very limited mediastinoscopy lymph node sampling done, and it becomes a conundrum. We know how many nodes that are negative, even if it's a 5 or 10% chance, no negative PETs that have microscopic disease in them. And so that's the only sort of specter that sort of is over this case that makes us a little suspicious. It still would not prompt me to treat this patient, but that's the only thing I'm wary of.
And again, this question of a TK inhibitor in the phenotype, or let's say this woman had the EGFR mutation done and she was positive. Let's say she was Asian. Is there anything, the tumor was bigger, is there anything, Ed, that would get you to consider or offer erlotinib as adjuvant therapy?
I will personally tell you I've done it with ERISA, because those are the ERISA days. And when the data was coming out with ERISA, certainly everybody was very cognizant of those phenotypic characteristics. The woman I treated was a 28-year-old female who only smoked for a couple years, had a mucinous adenocarcinoma stage 2 resected, and so we actually gave her adjuvant chemo. It was just around the time where the adjuvant chemo data had come out, and I did try to give her maintenance ERISA. She actually had such a profound rash to it that she couldn't tolerate it.
Back to you, Roy, again, any situation where you would use erlotinib off study as adjuvant therapy?
Well, just to clarify a bit too, you know, the patients where the tremendous responses were seen were, I think, in adenocarcinoma with BAC features as opposed to a pure BAC. So I would probably want to get a little bit more data regarding the pathology. But even there, I have used erlotinib for patients with BAC, but patients with non-surgical disease, more advanced settings. Here in an adjuvant setting, if there is clearly no measurable disease, the drug is quite benign, that's true, but it is a drug, it can have some side effects, and to do it without data outside of a trial, I probably wouldn't do it right now. Certainly, I think this is an area where clinical trials need to be developed. Now, what correlates with BAC features? Is it gene mutation, perhaps? Is it something with gene amplification needs to be looked at? Is it EGFR protein or phosphorylated protein overexpression? Again, needs to be looked at. But off of a study, I wouldn't relegate this patient for an indefinite period of adjuvant therapy with this agent.
Does the fact that it was hypermetabolic on PET scan concern you that it may not be a pure bronchoalveolar?
Doesn't smell like a real BAC. You know, that's usually a multifocal process. And again, you're right, BAC normally does not. And as Ed was mentioning, you know, the staging, that is one concern. You often won't see small nodules on a PET scan if they are BAC. So it just makes you think a little bit more to take another peek at that pathology.
So you want to follow up with what happened with her?
She did well until March 04 when she developed a malignant left pleural effusion. This was treated up at Moffitt Cancer Center. She had a chest tube pleurodesis. She was restaged with a PET scan that showed evidence of multiple pleural-based hypermetabolic nodules. She was put on a clinical trial at Moffitt with carboplatin and gemcitabine. She didn't respond. In September 04, she was started on ERISA, and CAT scan showed gradual shrinkage of the nodule. But approximately 8 weeks later, she developed elevated liver function studies, modest elevations in her transaminases. Then with continued follow-up, they were into the hundreds. The ERISA was held, the LFTs improved, she was rechallenged, liver functions went up again. However, after a period of time, she was put on Tarceva, had absolutely no problems with abnormal liver function tests, and has been maintained on Tarceva since that time with a good, stable, partial response. And that's close to a year and a half.
So a year and a half between the two TK inhibitors. Any rash or problems with the Tarceva?
Maybe a grade 1 rash, easily treated with Cleosin gel.
Roy?
Did you re-biopsy her at all before you did this, or you were still working off that original biopsy?
She had positive cytology in the pleural fluid, but I don't think she had a pathologic biopsy.
So positive cytology, multiple nodules at this point, mostly pleural-based?
Pleural-based.
Mostly pleural-based. And brain scans have been done, and those have remained negative. So, and her performance status now is good? She's doing well?
0-1.
On single-agent erlotinib?
Yes.
What do we know about liver toxicity with the TK inhibitors?
They certainly are metabolized through the liver, but it's very rare to see transaminitis, which it sounds like was seen. I was thinking the patient might have had disease in the liver, but that was not seen. This is an interesting case. It would be nice now to correlate that with some pathological data. You know, did this patient in fact have a mutation in exon 19, 20, 21? The patients who tend to have dramatic response, certainly her being a never smoker would put her in that group. Although, as we know with erlotinib, the survival data doesn't correlate, at least the early data, with mutation positivity. The best correlation has been seen with FISH positivity, meaning multiple copies or amplification of the EGFR gene and consequently of greater EGFR protein and activated protein.
Mike, I'm just wondering, do you routinely get EGFR on all of your tissue, which is from non-small cell?
We're not. Even at Anderson, the turnaround time can be as much as 4 weeks. The problem often is getting the tissue block. Will there be enough tissue? I'll just give you an example. I just recently treated a woman, an oligosmoker. She had reported about 100 cigarettes in her lifetime, you know, some use in college. And she came in, and she had been operated at an outside hospital, came in with widely metastatic lung cancer, disease in the brain, the spine, multiple lesions in the lungs. And who knew where even to get her block from by the time we get the block and do EGFR staining or mutational status. So we just started her on Tarceva. And by the time the block came in about 2 months later and we analyzed it, she had already had a wonderful response. It did turn out that this patient had a deletion in exon 19, which correlates best with response. So I'm not really using it in daily practice. I'll treat patients with these inhibitors in the second and third line setting, you know, without even worrying about it in the frontline setting. I'll think, is there a clinical characteristic that might lead me to treat them? But it is helpful, you know, in some settings, if you wanted to use it as neoadjuvant setting, if you were going to do adjuvant therapy, we talk about adjuvant therapy, it might be nice at some point to know a little bit about the tissue, know if there's gene amplification or EGFR mutation. But we're not doing it routinely, even though the test I know is now available. There's a licensed test that's available in many laboratories around the country. Ed, are you using it?
No, I would have to echo your sentiments on that, Roy. You know, the question I always ask is, and we don't know this for sure yet, is if the woman was an Asian female non-smoker adenocarcinoma and you did send the test and it was negative for mutation, would you not treat her? The answer is you're probably going to treat her. And so I think right now, although we can detect some positivity of mutations in some of these patients, we still don't know whether that's the best test or the complete test. And certainly there are going to be other patients who can respond to these drugs who have phenotypic characteristics and maybe in lieu of some of these mutational characteristics.
Right. The one thing we definitely do know is that the mutation is not the whole story. I think at the end of 2005, there were enough pieces of data from enough places that would suggest that it's one piece of a puzzle that's going to include copy number, protein expression, and probably a whole host of downstream markers and the other HER receptors. So tissue needs to be collected. One thing I think is critical is that lung cancer trials and even patients being treated on pathways, we start to bank the tissue because ultimately we are going to have to correlate outcome with something in the tissue and then ultimately something in the serum that can be measured with a 10-minute assay that's non-invasive. But we're not there yet, but hopefully that can be accumulated so it will be there when the tests are developed.
I'm just kind of curious, in your patient who had the mutation and the great response, did she also get tested for protein expression and gene copy number?
Well, we haven't done gene copy number yet, but we will. Protein expression was just in the normal range. But, you know, the protein is such a variable measure. You know, I like to liken it to, you know, you have a car. You know, the protein is like the car, but if it has no gas, it's not going to go. And really what we're worried about is the gas, which is, of course, the phosphorylation. And very few studies out there in the literature have looked at phosphorylated or activated receptor. And even if someone wanted to do that, it's very hard to do technically because the tissue has to be preserved in such a way that it's put immediately into formalin in the operating room, and that's not often done, or it's very difficult. You know, the time from resection of a lung tumor to the time that it makes it into formalin can be very variable. So those data sets are hard to interpret. So why one versus the other would have differential toxicity, this is why it's good to have a choice. But clearly, this patient is one of those patients who demonstrates response, which is still only in the 10% or so range to these agents. And I would bet if we looked at her tumor, she's either going to have either an EGFR mutation or FISH overexpression. So now the concern would be, how long will this last? There has been the development of resistance seen to these agents, and one needs to just watch her closely. I'd probably scan her, you know, every 3 or 4 months, and at the first sign that something's happening, think about adding something else in.
Ed, any thoughts about this case?
I'm extremely puzzled by a case like this, and I think it humbles us when we see cases like this because of the liver toxicity. Tarceva was branded originally as a more toxic version of Iressa. So to see similar structure drugs, although we know there are other inherent differences, where the lower dosed drug is the one that's causing all of the profound transaminitis and the higher dosed drug is actually the one that's exceptionally tolerable, really is puzzling to me. And I think that makes this a very interesting case. And it teaches us a lesson that indeed these are different drugs, even though you only have very minor structural changes in a compound. It's not all just dose related. And in fact, this may be the reason why you have two positive trials out there, one in lung and one in pancreatic with this drug.
You mentioned the issue, Roy, of what her next therapy might be. What would you think about if she progressed objectively, for example, and still clinically stable?
Well, she's basically received the EGFR inhibitors, and we can basically call it either Iressa or Tarceva. She's received the EGFR inhibitors as second-line therapy here. So one option, if she were to progress, would be to use another chemotherapeutic agent. And, of course, the agents one would consider would be pemetrexed or docetaxel. I'm quite partial to the combination of bevacizumab, erlotinib, Avastin, Tarceva. We published recently a phase 2 experience at MD Anderson and Vanderbilt where that combination in second or more line therapy had a time to progression over 6 months, close to 7 months, with a median survival seen in that setting of over a year. Those data are currently being confirmed at ASCO this year. We'll hear about a phase 2 randomized trial that was done throughout the United States, so a large multicenter experience. There's actually a trial that's ongoing looking in the metastatic setting, second line at Avastin Tarceva versus Tarceva. It's the so-called beta 2 lung trial. We don't have all those data. We just have the early experience and some more experience that I can share, having been involved in the other trials. I probably would, if there were no contraindications, you know, i.e. disease in the brain, this patient clearly doesn't have squamous cell cancer, I would consider adding in Avastin. I think if you're seeing some activity with either chemotherapy, as we've seen with Avastin in multiple tumor types when it's added to chemotherapy, or in this case with the EGFR inhibitor, that might be a good point to add those two in, and it would be something to try, either on trial, or she might not qualify for the trial just because of the way she's come to this, do it. And in many cases, I've seen this getting reimbursed recently as well.
Are you more inclined to do this because she's had such a great response to the TK inhibitor?
I am. I think that I probably wouldn't do it off of a study or recommend it off of a study in someone cold. I think if someone's coming in and you want to give the combination of an EGFR inhibitor and an angiogenesis inhibitor, I would really, you know, I'm a great proponent of clinical studies. That's what I do. But I think in this case, we already have someone who is responding. In our site, we probably would send the tissue off to our pathologist and run a whole set of tests and add her to the database. And again, we're keeping track of this, mutations, copy number, secondary mutations. But the fact that she has had some activity, I think this would be a reasonable setting to consider adding in the angiogenesis inhibitor.
I'm curious, Dr. Siegel, have you ever used that combination of Tarceva and Avastin? And what do you think about this idea?
I haven't used the combination. It sounds plausible, but let me ask another question. If we didn't use Avastin, say we were going to start chemotherapy with a taxane, would you still continue the Tarceva, even if she objectively progressed on it?
Well, you know, that becomes a big question, you know, that I grapple with and we all probably grapple with is we see patients who are benefiting from the EGFR inhibitor. So that's a selected group. It's not the group that was treated on the Tribute trial, all comers who got carboplatin paclitaxel for the drug. And one might think that this is a group where adding in the chemotherapy might have a benefit. And certainly we know that the never smokers who were treated with chemotherapy plus erlotinib had a wonderful outcome, a median survival of over 20 months, but it was a small group of patients. I don't know. The problem here is we might have missed our window. If we're using that logic, now at the point where she's starting to progress, you have to assume that something has changed in her EGFR axis, that there still might be a benefit of the drug, but it's not a benefit in terms of apoptosis, the tumor cells dying. I probably wouldn't mix the two. I probably would either add in an anti-angiogenic agent or, you know, you could look for trials. There are so many new agents right now. If you didn't want to give chemotherapy, some of these combination tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have dual EGF, VEGF inhibitory activity that are out there. There's a drug ZD6474 that's in clinical trial. Some of the Bayer compound that's now approved for renal cancer is going to be looked at carefully in lung cancer. So there are many other options, but I probably would not combine at this point. Now, we are doing a trial. It's funny that you ask right now where we are taking patients who are getting some of these agents, and we're taking the responders or stable disease patients, and then we're asking the question, we're randomizing them to chemotherapy versus staying on the biologic agent. That's a study that needs to be done.
That's fascinating. Mike, can you present your case?
Sure. So this is a chap who is in his 60s, smoker, who presented with a right upper lobe pulmonary mass. He had a 2.5 to 3 centimeter mass. He had a PET scan and had disease only in the lung, did not have a mediastinoscopy, was taken to surgery and had a right upper lobectomy, and was staged as a 1B. This was not squamous cell. This is a gentleman in excellent health. He's in his 60s, works for the county school system, and does some moderate physical labor and has no significant problems doing that. He does have, interestingly, polycystic kidney disease, and that's the only problem he's had. He's entirely asymptomatic from that. His creatinines have always run in the high normal range but have never been abnormal. He does have one brother who wound up on dialysis from polycystic disease. No evidence of the polycystic disease elsewhere, not in the liver or any other organs. So in terms of his performance status, he was in excellent condition.
And how did he tolerate the surgery?
Surgery in and out of the hospital in 3 days.
So, Ed, how would you have thought through this man's therapy, or are there any other questions you want to ask about that?
So you mentioned there was a PET done beforehand, and the lymph node staging that was done at the surgery time?
Was not a full mediastinoscopy, in kind of reference to your prior comment, which I thought was interesting considering you'll see what's happened here, because he was PET negative. He did not have a mediastinoscopy. He went directly to surgery. There was the usual interlobar and the Hiler sampling, and that was all negative. To my recollection, he had about 4 lymph nodes, which were negative for malignancy. And as I said, had a very nice recovery.
Yeah, again, this is a little larger tumor than our previous case. It is a 1B, and I'm assuming it's within the last year or two that he's seen you and been treated. So there is data out there to suggest, and carbotaxol is consistent with the CLGB9633 study, where they did give 4 cycles of adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel to a stage 1B population, showing a 12% benefit at 4 years as far as survival. And so it was a very reasonable approach. But again, I think the more and more we see these small lung tumors, and now medical oncologists are seeing these resected patients more and more often, I just get these danger flags that go up when there's not a full mediastinoscopic sort of examination done, and you just wonder what's left in there. We've all seen T1s that are metastatic. We've all seen T2s that are metastatic. Size matters up to a point, but it doesn't so much with lung cancer.
So what would you have likely offered him, assuming he's already had his surgery, comes to you post-op? If he came to see you today, what would you likely offer him?
If he's in very good shape, I probably would have considered, although the polycystic kidney disease does bother me, and I just remember that fact, a carboplatin-based regimen is very reasonable. I like to use Taxotere rather than Taxol. It's got a few less side effects, especially neuropathy, and that's one of the things, you know, when you treat a curative intent patient, you don't want them to suffer anything additionally. I think he's also a perfect candidate for any type of clinical trial, and there are clinical trials that are being developed right now combining Avastin as well as other agents in the adjuvant setting. So certainly those are things to consider in him.
So, Roy, this man comes to you and says, cost is not an issue. I'll pay for whatever medications. I've read about bevacizumab. It looks very encouraging. Will you give it to me in addition to whatever chemo you're going to give me?
Not outside a clinical trial. I think for sure, from what we've heard, this patient stage is a 1B, should get adjuvant chemotherapy with a platinum-containing regimen, using caution given his kidney disease. And, you know, we have the data with carboplatin paclitaxel from the U.S., cisplatin vinorelbine published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year from Canada. One can make a case for using docetaxel as well. I agree. So I think that I would clearly treat him. But to add in the anti-angiogenic agent, that is going to be the main research question probably of the whole intergroup mechanism over the next year. It's quite obvious. You take your best regimen in the metastatic setting and you bring it earlier. Look at what that's done in the breast cancer treatment with Herceptin, you know, in the adjuvant setting. So that's going to happen with anti-angiogenesis in lung cancer. But in the absence of a trial, I think it still is an unproven question. There are risks of thrombosis, whether they be venous or arterial in a potentially cured patient. We don't know what's going to happen as far as the wound and the bleeding from the resection. So I suspect it's all going to be very doable, but it needs to be done in a clinical trial setting.
Mike, you know, I am intrigued by your comment about Taxotere being better tolerated than paclitaxel. And that's not my impression clinically in terms of our patient population. And I would say that we do tend to see more skin toxicity with the Taxotere. We tend to see more of the peripheral edema. And I think most significantly in our population is the asthenia that one tends to see.
May I ask what dose of Taxol you're using?
On a Q3 week, it'll be between 135 to 150 per meter squared.
Yeah, and that's the real issue, is that we tend to underdose the Taxol quite a bit. And I would say if you used a similar dosing schedule with Taxotere, you would be dosing anywhere between 45 and 50 per meter squared Q3 week at an equivalent dose, because the full dose of Taxol being 225 per meter squared over 3 hours, with Taxotere at 75. And so definitely if you're using 75 of Taxotere as your experience, and that's what we've ingrained and learned, and you're not using 225 of Taxol, I would totally agree with your statement that you will see better tolerability. But I would challenge to say if you used 45 of docetaxel or 50 of docetaxel, you would find it to be very easy with less asthenia as well.
I guess the other thing, Ed, is the question of intent to treat. We hear you're trying to improve cure rate. I think we're kind of used to thinking about this taxane question in the palliative setting, but what do we know about dose and adjuvant effect in lung cancer?
Well, if you believe Terry LeChevalier, he was big on getting a certain amount of cisplatin dose in to his patients in the trial. And the goal they set forward with is 240 per meter squared in the international adjuvant lung trial. And so that's why they gave you multiple different dosings for cisplatin and just get to 240 somehow. I don't think we have any data to suggest dose intensity right now in lung cancer makes that big a difference. And we are used to treating people in the metastatic setting and others. But I think now when we start considering treating people like in breast cancer, like in colon cancer, in an adjuvant setting, you don't really want to go back too far on the dose, and you want to try and give them their full few cycles because you know it's not going to be indefinite, and so we feel we can tolerate that.
Let's get back to this case.
Did okay for a couple of months. I was about to restage him when he came into the office complaining of some chest discomfort and increasing fatigability as well as dysphagia. I examined him, and he had, once again, an unremarkable physical exam. His BUN and creatinines had remained stable throughout the treatment. But I got to repeat the PET CT scan, and not to be surprised, sure enough, there was moderately extensive mediastinal disease with both paratracheal and subcarinal lymphadenopathy.
And again, he was still asymptomatic?
Well, I think a bit more symptomatic in terms of he was feeling some pressure symptomatology as well.
Pressure, where did he feel it?
Esophageal. He had some mild dysphagia, which prompted a bit of weight loss.
Any suggestion of SVC?
No, no evidence of SVC.
Okay, Roy, so you have a patient who's progressing, has some tumor-related symptoms just a couple months after finishing carbotaxol. What are your thoughts?
Right, so he's basically grown right through the carbotaxol with this disease. Yeah, so you have a very difficult situation here, someone who is primarily refractory to platinum-based therapy with symptoms. So he's going to need to meet a radiation oncologist right away. So that would be my next step. And then the decision would be whether to treat him with radiation alone or try to bring in some second-line chemo in combination with the radiation.
What kind of chemo?
Well, as far as chemo, you know, this is always a tough question. Now we're going to want to radiate. And I think if we are going to radiate and he has a reasonable performance status, we probably should radiate with chemotherapy. The patient's already had platinum and been somewhat refractory. The platinum could still have an effect as a chemosensitizer. So one option would be to give him some platinum, you know, just give him the carbotaxol in weekly doses.
You would give him carbotaxol even though he just progressed?
Oh, well, that's the problem. That's what makes you uncomfortable, the fact that you also realize that there's a systemic disease to treat as well. There aren't that many good alternatives right now as to what to use. There's some data now out there with pemetrexed with Alimta in combination with radiation, and it's pretty well tolerated, you know, 500 milligrams per meter squared IV over a short period of time, 10 minutes every 3 weeks. So one option might be to give that in combination with carboplatinum. Actually, at MD Anderson, Ralph Zinner and our group piloted a trial of that in the metastatic setting and very well tolerated. So I've done that on a few occasions in a patient like this. I still probably would give some carboplatinum too, and you can give that with the radiation therapy. But I think for sure radiation therapy would be the way to go here.
What about Taxotere?
Well, I'll defer to Ed on that. I think that certainly that's a reasonable way to go as well. With weekly dosing, I assume, is what you would recommend.
Ed?
So the PET scan was the only thing done on this gentleman, right?
PET CT, CT to document recurrence.
Did we do a full staging afterwards with an MRI of the brain or other things?
MRI of the brain has been ordered and is pending next week.
Assuming it's negative, then we're looking at really a local recurrence of his primary disease growing through chemotherapy, which is obviously concerning, but still local. And so that's, I think Roy alluded to this quite often, is that, you know, radiation is exactly the first thing we would consider. And if we discussed with him and told him that this could either be microscopic metastatic elsewhere and we didn't think the chances of cure were possible anymore, then we could do sequential therapy. We could do radiation and then start him back on another metastatic regimen. Or if we wanted to try and treat with best intent and take a risk and give him a concurrent chemoradiation schedule because it is just local recurrence that we're having, that would be a discussion in a multidisciplinary fashion between the surgeon, radiation oncologist, and the medical oncologist. I think if we wanted to give chemotherapy with radiation, then certainly docetaxel as a single agent is a possibility. 30 per meter squared weekly has been the MTD with radiation, and that is a full dose of single agent docetaxel weekly. The other regimen that I use often is a cisplatin with docetaxel regimen, 20 per meter squared of both weekly. And Hak Choi has done studies using carboplatin with docetaxel at AUC of 2, as well as docetaxel at between 20 and 25 per meter squared.
Do you see bevacizumab fitting into this man's therapy either now or in the future?
I guess where I would see it is that if we considered him metastatic and we used the radiation as a local control measure because of his symptoms, then I wouldn't have a problem giving him Avastin afterwards, although he did have polycystic kidney disease and they can have berry aneurysms up in their brain, and that's the only thing that I would sort of throw caution to the wind. And an MRI is not going to pick up a berry aneurysm. So,
Roy, what about the general concept of second or third line bevacizumab?
Well, I think what we're going to see is that in most cases, people will use the bevacizumab in the frontline setting. But in a case like this, yes, this would be a case where one could consider a chemotherapy combination with bevacizumab. Again, once the radiation treatment is complete, you know, the bringing up of bevacizumab to radiation therapy has come slowly because there have been concerns about central lesions and about, you know, tumors of this type might bleed. Now, clearly, if you're radiating first or you're combining with radiation, that might be exactly the way to get around that potential problem. And the RTOG and SWOG both will soon have trials that are looking at bevacizumab at Avastin with radiation. Right now, there aren't those data yet, so I probably wouldn't add it in with the radiation. Though every preclinical paper you read shows how almost every anti-angiogenic agent studied improves, actually, in the short term, oxygenation to the tumors and actually enhances radiation effects. So that's going to be a real winner, but it's just going to take some time, in my opinion. But I do think this is someone who would be a great candidate after this for a second-line protocol that contains docetaxel with Avastin, Alimta with Avastin, Tarceva with Avastin. And there are these trials are all out there. You name it. These combinations are there. But I would still try to do it in a clinical trial if one was available.
Mike, can you follow up with this patient? Have you decided what you're going to do, or what do you think?
Well, he was somewhat resistant to proceed with a radiation therapy consultation for some social issues, but we've resolved those, and so he's going to be seeing the radiation therapist actually next week. And actually, my treatment plan was weekly Taxotere at 30 per meter squared, but I also wrote a treatment plan for Avastin, just really to see whether the insurance would approve that. I'm not entirely sure whether I'm going to use that concomitant with radiation chemotherapy, and that was one of the reasons why I presented him today, to kind of get your input on that, and we'll see.
Yeah, you know, these are tough cases. You know, this is the reason why it's nice to have a multimodality tumor board for this type of situation, and we've had a lung cancer conference at MD Anderson forever, but just in the last year did we start presenting every single multimodality case. And no two are the same, you know, these days. There are so many different, you know, possibilities regarding radiation, type of radiation, concurrent therapy with different agents, bringing the new biologics. These cases really are the most challenging and also with the greatest gain, because this is the area, in my opinion, we've made the most benefit. Now, this case is a little bit difficult because it's sort of happening as a recurrence. Hopefully this will be effective. We'd love to have some follow-up on that.
It's interesting. Clinical investigators are always very evidence-based and cautious about bringing things in too early, you know, to clinical setting. But Ed, you know, I'm this guy, younger man in perfectly good health, you know, sort of walked right through carboplatinum. And he turns around and says to you, okay, well, you know, you're suggesting radiation therapy, maybe some chemo. And, you know, the Avastin is really kind of a more experimental idea. If I go down that track, what am I looking at?
Well, I think as long as patients are informed of what the data are, where the data could be in the future, it's okay to explore those things. And obviously, I don't know if I would have him spend all the money out of pocket to do that, but if it is approved, we certainly have Taxotere and Avastin data that shows it's tolerable. The big question, as Roy brought up, is the radiation. And yes, it is risky, but you're looking at a situation where you're trying to salvage a gentleman who underwent a surgery, thought he was cured of cancer just 2 months ago after he finished the four cycles of chemotherapy, and you're trying to get your hands around this disease. And although I agree the Avastin is a little bit more of a stretch at this point because of the fact that there isn't a lot of data out there now, even in clinical trials with it, it's not something that is totally unreasonable as long as that's an agreement between you and the patient.
And again, Roy, what would you say to him if he says, without some newer approach, just following kind of standard procedure here, what am I looking at in terms of prognosis? What's the chance that I'm going to be feeling okay in 6 months? What's the chance that I'm going to be alive in a year?
Well, it's poor. You know, I'd look at this as 3B or worse, where, you know, the chance of recurrence here within a year is going to be high, within 5 years, 80 or 90%. So I think that in this case, you do want to do something different. You know, there are, unfortunately, are not as many protocols for this setting as one would like. If he really wanted to try the Avastin, I would carefully discuss the risks and unproven benefits. There are some data that are out there now, safety data for docetaxel plus Avastin, so it probably is safe to do. in the absence of the radiation. Whether to do it with the radiation, I'm not sure. At ASCO this year, it's still blinded, so I'm not aware of the data even myself. There will be presented a 120-patient trial that looked at Avastin Taxotere versus placebo Taxotere versus Avastin Tarceva, three different arms. It's a small trial, but it's a multi-center setting, so there will be some data on the books after the ASCO this year. Hopefully that will help with this decision in the future. But again, I think that what I would probably tell him is do the standard radiation with a chemotherapy. And the one you've chosen is just fine. And then I would try to get him on something other than plain chemotherapy, because I'm the first to agree that chemotherapy by itself in this situation is not good enough for anyone in either a clinical trial, or if he's really wanting to take the risk and perhaps even assume the cost, perhaps we could try something.
I had a question regarding Avastin and the risk of bleeding in squamous cell carcinomas. It was my understanding that the risk was primarily due to the frequent central location of the tumors and not inherent on the biology of squamous cell carcinomas. If that's the case, is it safe to use it in adenos and large cells that are central in location?
That's a very good question. You know, at Anderson, with Dave Johnson and the group at Vanderbilt and several other sites, were involved in the early phase 2 studies of Avastin in lung cancer. You know, and that's where, of course, you know, 4 patients had severe hemorrhage. And clearly those were patients that had central lesions, and most of those were squamous tumors. And that's why the decision was made early on to avoid treating any squamous tumors. And it was a smart one, in my opinion, because when you're doing large clinical trials, if you were to say no central lesions, you know, you can imagine the calls the primary investigator would get each day. Is this a central lesion? Is this not? Now, when those squamous patients were left out of the ECOG trial that Alan Sandler presented at ECOG, there still was a bleeding rate of about 2%, and about 5 out of 400 bleeds, so about a little more than 1%, were due to hemoptysis. So still, even removing all the squamous cell carcinoma patients, there's about a 1% or more chance of bleeding from the lungs. Some of the patients bled from the brain or GI tract. Now, we have not seen the final data set from this report yet, so we don't know how many of those patients had central lesions. Someone out there has to put together an algorithm of who bleeds, why they bleed. I think you have to assume that it probably is the central location. It probably indicates that this drug is working great in lung cancer. It's exactly what you would expect. Tumors will cavitate. The problem is the real estate of the lung is very tortuous, the very loose connective tissue area. There isn't a lot of tamponade, you know, occurring there. I think anyone you treat with this agent has to be warned about the risk. However, the risk is small, I think, compared to the potential benefits in a completely incurable setting. That being said, I have treated some patients that have central lesions with adenocarcinoma, but I have been nervous about it, and I've watched very carefully, and I try not to do it if at all possible. You have to sort of evaluate on a case-by-case basis.
Dr. Hussain?
Yes, I wanted actually to ask regarding the patient of Michael. We talked about the two taxanes that we are using, paclitaxel and docetaxel. Do you have any experience with Abraxane, with its new package? Do you see any advantage for this drug to be combined with radiation, especially in somebody who stopped responding to the older ones?
Head.
So, you know, Abraxane, the technology with the nanoparticle is still Taxol. So it's Taxol packaged a special way. And the rationale is that you can get higher dose concentrations to the tumor. So the real question would be then, if someone failed Taxol, would increasing the dose of Taxol perhaps overcome that resistance? And the answer to that is probably not. So although I think Abraxane is a very good technology, and it's good that we have drugs like that now because they will be able to package others and perhaps we could get higher deliveries to these tumors, I don't see any benefit in giving it to patients right now who have failed taxanes, especially Taxol right now.
From a practical perspective in terms of patient care, assuming it had the same activity as paclitaxel in a patient who never had a taxane, how much of an advantage do you think the short infusion time and lack of need for premedication is, particularly in lung cancer?
I think those are very advantageous things about Abraxane, and that's why I welcome drugs that are sort of packaged this way, and hopefully there will be others in the future to use, because anything you can do to decrease the amount of time a patient would have spending on side effect management or even in the suite itself makes total sense. I think that's why cisplatin is not used very often in metastatic non-small cell, not because we feel it's a less potent agent. It's just that it's a time-consuming, arduous medicine to give that requires a lot of care throughout the cycle of therapy. And so that, I think, is a very good advantage for Abraxane. And there will be studies coming with Abraxane with all of these combinations to assess where best to use this type of strategy.
Do you have much experience, Dr. Hussain, with using nanoparticle Abraxane in breast cancer?
Yes, we have treated several patients with it. And as we said, patients tolerated very well. And like you said, 15 minutes infusion, no dacadrone the night before and the morning. You get the patient in and out very quickly, especially if you have 60 of them waiting. Therefore, it's clearly advantageous to patient. I recently treated a patient with lung. She has failed or she stopped responding to so many regimens. She reminded me of breast cancer. I mean, this lady, she has been going for the last 4 or 5 years with metastatic disease, progressing slightly on almost everything that we have went back to all their agents she received. And recently, after stopping responding to tyrosine kinase inhibitors, I put her actually on Abraxane. This is only 6 weeks ago, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, tolerating very well. We will see if she responds.
That reminds me of a case where we treated someone with carboplatin as a sixth-line agent because she'd had it in the way distant past and had a litany of agents afterwards and actually responded. And so it's a little different situation when you have immediately failed a drug and then having to give them something afterwards. Sort of how when Dr. Siegel was presenting his case, would you consider the Tarceva, to continue the Tarceva on that patient? I would do it in certain cases depending on how the disease is progressing. If all the nodules were growing in that case, perhaps, then the Tarceva clearly has stopped working. But I had a patient who had lung disease. It was controlled with an EGFR TKI, and then the new disease popped up in the liver. So clearly the tyrosine kinase inhibitor was doing its job in the lung, and then a new sort of subset of disease evolved from that and has come into the liver. So I added chemotherapy in that setting, and she had stable disease afterwards. So I think there's always roles that we're changing sort of the landscape of lung cancer as the therapies go, and that you could eventually retreat with some of these agents.
And Roy, it's always hard to tell whether you're looking at biology or the effect of treatment. You see a case like this that kind of looks like what we see in breast cancer. We're seeing more cases like that, I think, in colon cancer now as we have more effective agents. Do you think we're getting close to the point where we'll have enough agents in non-small cell that we can convert patients into this more chronic disease model?
Well, that's the hope. It gets to the whole argument recently of stem cells. And, you know, there's the thought that, you know, when you treat a tumor, you know, you might get 90, 95% of the cells, but you leave those more pluripotent cells in a tumor that are capable of regenerating the whole tumor. And I think the sense is that tumors are quite heterogeneous. And even if we do treat a tumor and we do have effective agents, resistance, of course, is going to develop even to some of these new targeted therapies. But we are making lung cancer, hopefully, into a chronic disease in some cases. And to do that, I think that the chemotherapeutics we use should be those that are easiest to give and least toxic, because if the patient's going to go on for longer, we want them to do that with fewer side effects. And we do need to be creative, and until we know exactly who responds to what and why, which needs to be a driving force in all that we do, we're going to need to continue to progressively treat with different regimens and hopefully, you know, different combinations as we're doing. And the thing that's nice in 2006 is that we have so many different combinations, and many of them, or most of them, reasonably well tolerated. So I like his analogy. It is looking more like the treatment in advanced breast cancer.
Steve?
There's a fair amount of data that gemcitabine may be the most potent radiation sensitizer, at least in gastrointestinal malignancies. And I was wondering, vis-a-vis the case that Dr. Troner presented, is there any data about combining radiation with gemcitabine in non-small cell lung cancer, since it is an active agent?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a long story. But when gemcitabine first became available, I guess it's almost 8 or 9 years ago now, some went forward immediately combining it with radiation at the full dose, I guess 1,000 milligram per meter squared, 1,250 milligram per meter squared, then given every 3 or 4 weeks, and the results were quite toxic. It's a very good radiation sensitizer. So then everything was damage control at that point to figure out how to use gemcitabine with radiation. Certainly the CLGB and Everett Vokes did a successful trial where I believe they picked a dose of 600 milligram per meter squared given every 3 weeks, and actually the tolerability was reasonable. The results didn't look much different than combinations with vinorelbine or taxane. Ralph Zinner in our group with Ritsuko Komaki actually looked at gemcitabine on a weekly basis with radiation, and they still haven't published those data, but from what I've seen, the efficacy results look reasonably good. Actually, the best piece of data out of that report will be the fact that they actually found that they could reduce the amount of toxicity if they used tomographic radiation and limited the amount of esophagus that was radiated. I think that in common practice now, I would steer clear of it. I think that The data set out there shows that it's a good radiation sensitizer, but it's somewhat toxic, and at the doses that one's going to have to use in order to make it tolerable, systemic activity is going to be questionable. Because if you start getting down below 500-600 milligrams per meter squared or lower every 3 or 4 weeks, or 2 out of 3 weeks, I think you're running into the situation where it's probably not having any systemic effect. That's why a drug like docetaxel or Taxol or Alimta, where you can give systemic doses with the radiation and have suitable toxicity, is probably better to use.
Okay, let's go on to Steve's case.
The next case is a 67-year-old white male who presented to his internist with a minimally productive cough. A chest x-ray was obtained in his office, and there was a infiltrate versus mass in the right lower lobe. The patient was treated with a course of oral antibiotics and had a repeat chest x-ray, which revealed no significant improvement in the infiltrate on chest x-ray. Patient then had a CT scan of the chest performed, which revealed the infiltrate to be more mass-like in appearance on the CT scan, measuring approximately 3.5 centimeters. There was a small hilar lymph node measuring 1.5 centimeters. No mediastinal adenopathy was identified. The patient did have a PET scan, which revealed increased metabolic uptake with high SUV values in the right lower lobe mass. There was a lower SUV value, but still increased uptake in the right hilum, and no obvious increased uptake within the mediastinum or elsewhere throughout the body. Patient was taken to mediastinoscopy, and at the time of mediastinoscopy was found to have N2 disease with contralateral mediastinal adenopathy. Biopsy revealed a poorly differentiated large cell carcinoma.
So, Head, how would you think this through?
Well, again, I think this is the third example in a row where we've had a PET scan done and the mediastinoscopy, a full mediastinoscopy, revealed a very different staging. As I was hearing this case, I'm thinking, wow, maybe we can resect this, maybe we can do neoadjuvant, and then now I hear contralateral lymphadenopathy. Now we've all of a sudden shifted our entire focus on this patient from something that was surgically feasible to now an unresectable concurrent chemoradiation approach, of course, if the rest of the staging is negative.
And what did the staging show? And could you talk a little bit more about his general health, attitude, et cetera?
He was obviously disappointed by the time he came to see me because up to the point of the mediastinoscopy, everyone was very hopeful and encouraging that he would be able to be resected at the time of his surgery. Of course, he was quite disappointed in that outcome. He was generally fairly healthy. He had hypertension. He was mildly obese. And he had had an abnormal stress test about 5 or 6 years earlier with a negative catheterization, and he actually had stopped smoking at that time when he had the abnormal stress test.
And did you mention the rest of his staging?
The rest of his staging was negative MRI of the brain, CT scans of the rest of the body, which had been done preoperatively prior to the mediastinoscopy with the intent that he might undergo definitive surgery. All of those were negative.
So, Ed, what would you be thinking about in terms of treatment?
Well, he sounds like a healthy gentleman, other than the abnormal heart history, and we'd want to make sure that that was okay. If it was a couple years ago, then he might need to just a cardiology consultation to clear his cardiac status.
He did have preoperative cardiac clearance, and he had a stress test, which was fine.
Perfect. So right now I'm thinking we have to talk with the radiation oncologist and decide the planning with concurrent chemoradiation. There's a lot of different agents that could be used. I can sense his disappointment already, as I was disappointed when you said contralateral lymph nodes as well. The two regimens that I usually prefer, one is the SWOG 9504 regimen using cis and etoposide. The cis is given on a day 1 and 8, 29, 36 regimen at 50 per meter squared, or the etoposide given on days 1 through 5 at 50 per meter squared, as well as days 29 through 33, and then 3 cycles of consolidation Taxotere afterwards. Of course, you can always consider him for a clinical trial. He sounds like a fit person, and if there is a trial around, as Roy has mentioned, with Avastin or some other agent, even Erbitux, it's something to consider. The other regimen that I used, I alluded to earlier, was a cisplatin and the Taxotere, 20 per meter squared of each given weekly.
And can you talk about what happened with this man?
He was treated. There was no clinical trial available at that time. This was a few months ago, so the Avastin trials were not open at that point. He was treated as per the prior SWOG study and received etoposide and cisplatin with concurrent radiation therapy, and that was followed with the Taxotere every 3 weeks at 75 per meter squared. He tolerated fairly well. He had, I would say, grade 2 esophagitis towards the end of his combined modality therapy. He did have a moderate degree of chemotherapy and radiation-induced anemia, for which he was treated with erythropoietin agent. And during the Taxotere, we decided to prophylactically treat him with Neulasta along with the Taxotere, and he had no significant problems with neutropenia during the Taxotere portion of the treatment.
So now how far out is he?
He's now approximately 6 months out and so far doing beautifully. A repeat PET scan upon completion of therapy was negative, and CT scans, MRI of the brain were also negative.
Roy, how do you approach selection of chemotherapeutic regimen to combine with radiation in this situation?
Well, I think this is a very good choice that you made. The data from the SWOG Phase 2 report and the recent data from the Phase 3 report of the 0023, which was actually trying to do better than this by adding ERISA in the maintenance setting, while there was no benefit seen to the ERISA, at least the aggregate data suggests that this combination continues to look like a winner. And there's also, of course, a randomized trial ongoing through the Hoosier Oncology Group, which will hopefully at some point give us a randomized answer versus a standard regimen. I think that all the data over the last five or more years, actually, since the lung cancer meeting in Ireland, when we first heard about a group from Japan that did it, suggests that concurrent chemoradiation therapy is the way to go. And, you know, one can do it with docetaxel in the consolidation setting with cisplatin etoposide. A lot of doctors in Houston and at MD Anderson will use carboplatin paclitaxel just because of ease of administration, giving it weekly during the radiation followed by two cycles of consolidation carboplatin. I think that's very reasonable as well. So there are many different combinations here. As we've discussed, I think in the next year or so, we're going to start seeing the Avastin brought into this setting as well.
Has he had repeat imaging studies? Did you say what they showed?
Yes, the repeat studies. He had studies immediately upon completion of therapy, and then he's had subsequent studies done at three-month intervals. He's about 6 months out now.
And what do they show?
He has some residual scar tissue, you know, post-radiation changes within the right lower lobe, nothing at all within the high lower mediastinal areas, and PET scan of the right lower lobe area is negative, as well as the, for what it's worth, the mediastinum, since it was negative
preoperatively. He's feeling well?
Feeling very well. He's back to playing golf and, you know, his normal activities.
So, Ed, this man says to you, what's the chance that I'm going to be in the same situation, feeling great without any progression of the disease 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Yeah, so that is the big problem. And even in the metastatic setting, when I'm talking with patients, I always tell them what the 5-year survival is in the best case scenario, a stage 1A that's resected. And even in our curative intent patient in the stage 3B setting, the 5-year survivals are not great. The reported 5-year survival in this phase 2 SWOG study was 29%, which makes it very impressive. However, it still is only a phase 2 multicenter single-arm trial. Generally, you would say probably 15% are alive at 5 years with lung cancer in stage 3B. And so it's not good. And it doesn't make the patient feel much better, but he's got to realize he's already in a minority section of lung cancer where he's done well. He's had 6 months where the disease has, as you say, disappeared on PET. I think that's great because many times after chemoradiation, you're going to see something in their low SUV, and it just makes everybody nervous. It is within normal limits to have that type of inflammatory reaction. But as we said before, the PET was negative previously, so how much utility is it helping us now?
What fraction of these patients, and of course it's going to be based on older data, now we're much more aggressive about imaging and newer therapies. This man, as you said, is already down the line a little bit. But what fraction of patients like this are, I'm going to use the word, cured of their lung cancer, will die of something else without any evidence of progression of the lung cancer?
I am an optimist when it comes to lung cancer, but I'm also a realist. And that's why even the term I use is curative intent. I don't think you can ever be cured of a disease. It becomes chronic, as you alluded to earlier and Roy had alluded to. And this is now a chronic disease. I tell them not to be anxious the entire 2 3/4 months during their time away. And then they can be anxious for that 1 week period when they come and get their scans and have to see the oncologist to determine whether there's recurrence. And I tell people, you know, it's out of your control unless you start smoking again. And so enjoy the time that you have with lung cancer. I just hate using that word cure, but as time goes, we will be able to state more that this patient is cured. But right now, it's a little early.
Okay, so I won't use the word cure, Roy. I'm going to say this man says to you, what's the chance that 5 years from now, I will not have any evidence of disease progression and be alive and well?
You know, I was thinking of an answer as Ed was talking. Basically, if you look at lung cancer, the overall 5-year survival for all stages is 15%, and we'll probably get an update in the next year or two that it's gone up to 16 or 17%. But this is a lot of patients. We're talking 170,000 deaths a year in the United States. The one thing, you know, the glass half full in stage 3 disease, I think we have the best evidence that we can cure or at least, you know, make lung cancer a chronic disease, because I think that the advances in radiation and chemotherapy and combined modality therapy clearly have moved the bar upward in this setting of disease. And certainly as someone who treats only lung cancer in their practice now, I look at stage three as our greatest success right now, because we can treat locally and we can treat metastatic disease. That being said, you know, we have, or at least until recently, had a 5-year survivor's party for patients with lung cancer that was organized by our radiation oncologists. And each year we'd get about 5 to 10 patients. And this is from the entire practice. And again, these are people that are coming. But my sense is that in this setting, you know, I would say it's 5 to 10% of patients max, even with all the therapies. It's maybe close to 15%. It's a small number. But again, these are the patients that need to be treated with curative intent, with aggressive chemo and radiation on time. We have better ways now of alleviating the side effects, whether they be hematologic or esophageal or whatever. So it's a small number of patients, but this is a group that can have long-term survival. It's not quite as good as some of the phase 2 data we've seen, but it's not zero, which is the case in anyone that has metastatic disease. And of course, with the scans that we do now, where this group, the stage migration has occurred as well. And certainly when, if we say someone has 3B now, we're pretty much more certain than we were 10 years ago that it's not stage 4. So you can cure some of these patients, but it's a small number. This is certainly the area to give our best effort.
I'm curious, Steve, has this man raised these kinds of questions with you?
He did, and actually we had a discussion very similar to what Roy just said, and I quoted him a number of approximately 10%, you know, that he would be around and doing well 5 years out. I had quoted him a number of approximately 10%.
I always try to remind patients that there are many ways to leave the earth, and so lung cancer can be one, but you know, heart disease is certainly something that exists, which he has had some problems with, strokes, other things. So I think it's important that, you know, people don't get so fixated. I tell people to wear their seatbelts when they're driving their car. If you watch the news, there are many ways to die. And so I think they just need to put that into perspective.
And smoking's up there, too.
Right.
Did he resume smoking?
No, he had stopped and never restarted.
Ed, what would be the chance, if he did make it 5 years, of developing another lung cancer? That's another concern, I know, big research interest.
So people who have smoking histories, you know, they have lifetime risks of developing second primary tumors. Anywhere between the 8% range that we've seen in some trials up to even 20% over their lifetime. And so he's at risk. Clearly, this is a direction of research that we're trying to pursue. Just like in this patient, we have a trial. He would not necessarily be eligible for this trial, but we are trying to look at resected lung and head neck cancer patients who have higher smoking histories to follow them chronically and do serial biopsies and even intervene with certain agents to try and prevent that tumor from occurring. And again, this is not a wide-scale phase 3 type of research endeavor because we've had too many large phase 3 trials in chemo prevention that have been negative, but we're trying to be more smart with biologically based rationale.
My experience with lung cancer and my head and neck patients is that they stop smoking. There was a great presentation at ASCO this last year, and they talked about the importance of the physician once again telling the patients, are you smoking? Would you stop smoking? Don't smoke. The importance of physician and nurse input really helps the patient a great deal in making sure they stay off cigarettes.
I'm curious, do you find that your patients with breast cancer or other non-smoking related cancers also quit smoking if they're smokers?
I think most of the breast cancer patients do stop smoking.
What's your experience, Dr. Hussain? Do you find any cancer sort of a wake-up call for a lot of people or not necessarily?
Yes, it is. It really is. For the vast majority, I would think 80 to 90% of people, they will stop if they have any cancer. I mean, you can scare them even, you know, basal cell cancer. Tell them, you know what, there is something else that can happen, and they will stop.
There are smoking cessation programs through American Cancer Society, American Lung Association, offer them the various pharmacologic agents available, whether it's a nicotine patch or Wellbutrin. But there's still a subset that say, you know, I already have cancer. It doesn't matter at this point. I'm going to continue smoking.
I don't find that the patients say that it has anything to do with their cancer. I just find that there's a subset of patients who just are unable to really make that final decision that it's time to stop. And, you know, what I always say to the patients is what I've learned over the years is that when you're ready, you have to pick a date, and then I'll be happy to write your Wellbutrin, and I'll be happy to write your patch. Just call me. I said, but I'm not going to write it until you have made that commitment and you have picked out a date that you're going to stop smoking. And that's the data that shows that's the patients who will stop smoking.
Where do you think sort of the guilt fits into the smoker who's developed lung cancer? Is that a topic that comes up in conversation with the oncologist, Ed?
There is a guilt, but it's a resolved guilt, almost like a poker player or a gambler. I know I shouldn't have spent all my money betting at the table. I feel a little bad about it, but, you know, I gained enjoyment from it. And really, not every smoker develops lung cancer. And so that's the other thing. You have to have a little bit of bad luck on your side, regardless of how extensive a smoker you are, to get this. And it's unfortunate that anyone gets it, but certainly smoking is something that has been known to relate to causality.
Roy? The converse of this is now look at all the non-smokers who get lung cancer. And you have a young woman in the office who's never smoked, you know, and she now has this disease, and which, you know, people will assume is due to smoking. Then, you know, sometimes family members wonder, is it something that we've done? Is it passive smoke? Was it because dad smoked or someone, you know, was exposed to asbestos? So that's an issue now as well. And it hurts, I think, research in lung cancer, because if you look at the funding of research in lung cancer compared to the other major solid tumors, compared to the number of deaths from lung cancer, it's really an underfunded disease. And that's due to many reasons, but I think part of it is this perception that it is a smoking-related disease. Also, because it's such a fatal disease, many of the patients don't stay around long enough to lobby, as one might, you know, with breast cancer and prostate cancer patients. You know, it affects everyone.
A number of lung cancer patients have said to me that when they tell people they have lung cancer, often the first question is, do you smoke or did you smoke? The most interesting way I heard a patient describe, this was a non-smoker with lung cancer, how she responds to that question of did you smoke is, why do you ask? We don't ask people with heart disease, what was your diet like, et cetera.
I think 2005 was an extremely symbolic year for lung cancer, especially from a national profile standpoint. You had Peter Jennings, who is a longtime smoker, male, and obviously his passing was pretty quickly. Then you had Dana Reif, who is a young woman, non-smoker, who was obviously hit by some very bad luck in her lifetime. I think it's particularly interesting, and I want to hear the comments from the other docs here, is when you have that patient who has that guilt and you describe that patient who stops smoking regardless of the cancer diagnosis, from a basal cell to a lung cancer, it's amazing to me to see how many of the family members continue to smoke.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Spouses even continue to smoke.
But one thing that I think we do need to push more, and we are, is the former smoker. So Ki Hong, who's our chairman, would call these the good citizens, the people who have reformed, they've stopped smoking, but then, of course, they're living with this increased risk of lung cancer forever, and perhaps they can get it down to double the population after 15, 20 years. So that's the group where I think the research and screening is going to be critical. Screening efforts have been somewhat plagued by the fact of nonspecific diagnoses, and what do you do with a small 5-millimeter lesion? That's hopefully being worked out as the trials of large numbers are going forward. And then, of course, what do you do when you find disease early? The problem is, as we've discussed today, even in the adjuvant setting, even when a tumor is removed as a stage 1B, there's a 40 to 50% chance at 5 years of recurrence. But now, hopefully, with better adjuvant chemotherapy, with some of the biologic agents we've talked about today, erlotinib, bevacizumab, and others, that might be something we can tackle.
It's interesting. Our group has done patterns of care studies where we've asked oncologists in practice, what do you do in different situations? It's interesting to see what the bar is for giving adjuvant therapy in breast cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancer. We said before that you wouldn't give chemotherapy to a 1A patient. What's the risk of relapse as 1A non-small cell? What would you say it is?
35 to 40%.
And you don't treat, and yet these guys are using chemotherapy for 10% risk of relapse in breast cancer. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Interesting difference there. Dr. Hussain, can you present your patient?
Yes. This is actually a patient I saw recently, 71-year-old woman who had an episode of cough and fever in July 2005. She presented to one of our hospitals, to the emergency room. She had a chest x-ray, and she was told it was normal, although I actually have not been able to locate the chest x-ray. She was discharged home on oral antibiotics. Her cough improved but did not completely subside. No hemoptysis. This is in July. In November 2005, the patient herself, while taking a shower, felt a lump over the frontal aspect of her skull. The MRI of the brain was done, and that revealed the presence of a 2.5 centimeter extraaxial subcutaneous mass on the right side of the scalp with no brain parenchymal abnormalities. CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis with intravenous contrast revealed the presence of a 3-centimeter speculated lesion in the upper lobe of the left lung. There were 3 less than 5 millimeter nodules in the right lung. There were multiple lytic lesions in the thoracic and lumbar spine, no hepatobiliary or pancreatic masses. Bone scan revealed the presence of abnormal accumulation in the spine and bilateral ribs.
What was her symptomatic state at that point? Was she having pain?
Yes, she was having mid-back and lower back pain.
And how long had she had it?
She had this shortly after the episode when she presented to the emergency room, August, September of 05.
Any other symptoms, weight loss, anything?
No, she did not lose weight at that time, but late November when she started being told she has all these abnormalities, she went sort of into depression and stopped eating. She lost around 5-6 pounds in the last 1 month.
And what was her general health like, other comorbidities?
No, she is otherwise a very healthy woman. She lives in the island. She comes back and forth to visit her family here. She had no heart, lung. She was told 6 years ago that she had a mass or a cyst on her kidney. That actually, when we repeated the scans here, she had the same thing. When the radiologist even compared the report to what we have, he told me it doesn't look like it has changed.
What kind of pain medication was she on for pain?
When I saw her, she was not on pain medicine.
Okay.
She was taking Advil and ibuprofen.
Okay, so she has some bone pain. Generally, she's in good condition, very functional. Ed, how would you think through her case?
Well, I was wondering about the smoking status on her as well.
Yes. You see, I ask smoking history actually at the end because of the reason you mentioned. I don't really like to say, oh, okay, you are coming here to see me for lung cancer. How long you smoked? I actually leave it at the end because I don't believe it. She had a 20-pack year history of smoking, but she quit completely 30 years ago.
And do we have a tissue diagnosis?
Yes. Excisional biopsy of the scalp mass revealed poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, TTF. One negative.
Ed?
Yeah, so right now we're dealing obviously with a stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer patient. She's got a primary lesion in the lung, suspicious small little lesions scattered in the lung, multiple documented lesions in the bone, as well as a subcutaneous lesion up on the cranial region of the head. It's a soft tissue and not invasive. First thing you want to do is obviously get this patient in shape. She's losing weight. She feels terrible. She has pain. We have a service at MD Anderson called the Palliative Care and Symptom Control Service. Ed Brewera is the chairman of this department. They are wonderful at helping manage any symptomatology related to cancer or even cancer treatment. And this is someone, if I were seeing this patient at Anderson, I would send her up there first because my philosophy on treating patients, and she's got a chronic road ahead of her, and she's either going to do very well or very poorly, is that we have to manage the pain and all the other aspects. Now, we can send her to radiation at the same time to have some of those pain aspects taken care of, but that's not going to help her appetite entirely, and it's not going to help her depression or dysthymia per se.
And once she stabilizes, assuming she did stabilize, what would you be thinking about in terms of therapy?
Yeah, I would consider this woman for combination chemotherapy with Avastin.
What specific regimen would you be likely to offer her?
Well, we have a phase 2 trial right now of carboplatin, taxotere, and Avastin. And if she was being treated here, that's what I would use at Anderson if we saw her. I think if you are outside of a clinical trial giving Avastin, you have options of using either taxane with carboplatin with Avastin.
Roy?
Yeah, this is a patient who clearly should get the best therapy out there right now, and that would be outside a clinical trial of Avastin. The median survival in the trial of carbotaxol versus carbotaxol Avastin through the ECOG was over 12 months for the group that got the Avastin. She doesn't have any contraindications to receiving the drug, and I think that that would be a very reasonable approach here as well. That being said, certainly this is an area now of lung cancer research that is just the largest single area of study, meaning new anti-angiogenic agents with chemotherapy. And there are going to be a number of different clinical trials, either soon to start or already started, looking at some of these small molecules that have anti-angiogenesis activity, such as a drug from Bayer, BAY-439006. That's going to be looked at in clinical trial. And there's a drug from AstraZeneca called AZD-2171 that's going to be looked at in this setting. So we're sort of at the point now in stage 4 therapy where we were 10, 12 years ago when carboplatin first appeared on the scene, where now it's going to be all other comers, you know, looking to find something that could be as good, if not better. My hope here is that some of these small molecules or some of the combinations will be better, because while we have found something that looks a little bit better, certainly it doesn't help all patients. So clinical trials, but in the absence of a study, I think you can make a very strong case in this patient for adding Avastin to carbotaxol.
Now, if she were, because of back pain or bone pain, were going to require radiation therapy for symptomatic relief, how would you handle that in terms of the timing of the chemotherapy or Avastin or even using it?
Well, I think in that case, where you'd just be treating with, you know, radiation for a few treatments, I would probably do that first, you know, before starting the chemotherapy. Certainly, if you had to break the therapy for a bit, you could do that. And I think if, depending on where you're radiating, I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
You mentioned some of these newer compounds. Any that you think are actually going to be in the oncologist's hands in the next 2 or 3 years in terms of being approved and being used?
Well, you know, the problem now is we're really in sort of a period that we were not fully prepared for, meaning that we now have phase 3 data with Avastin and chemotherapy, which is great. But we don't really have phase 2 data with some of these other compounds in combination with some of the chemotherapeutics. So it's hard to know which are the best candidates to go forward. So actually, if you look around at some of the large cooperative groups, there aren't many large phase 3 studies ongoing through the groups, you know, in the primary area of lung cancer, untreated stage 4 disease, because the next question is not clear. I think that we're going to see some of these agents that are looking interesting in early phase 1 or are active in other areas such as renal cancer, which have some activity as a single agent in lung cancer, jumping very quickly from phase 1, 2 to phase 3. There are going to be some studies in this BAY439006, which is a dual vascular endothelial growth factor and RAF inhibitor. That's going to go forward in combination with chemotherapy in a large randomized trial. This drug called AZD2171, which is multi-targeted vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitor from AstraZeneca, this is going to go forward in combination with carboplatin paclitaxel in a randomized trial. And, of course, there are a number of trials ongoing now trying to understand how to better use the EGFR inhibitors, either alone or with chemotherapy. But right now, these are just beginning, and they're somewhat high risk because there isn't a large amount of phase 2 data to really give us a good feeling that they're going to be active. But we're taking the concept that Avastin seems to be active. These are similar agents, perhaps easier to give because they're oral, and perhaps more active because they target more receptors. So that's going to be, I think, an approach we'll be seeing in the lung cancer research arena for a while.
Dr. Hussain, can you follow up about this patient?
Yes. What I did is I treated her with narcotics for her pain, sent her for a radiation oncology consult. She started radiation immediately. She finished the radiation on 12:30:05. But Ed, you are absolutely right. The main trouble I'm facing with her is her appetite. I put her on Magaze, knowing it's adenocarcinoma, it might increase the risk of DVT, but I didn't have anything else to do. I think probably she might benefit from an antidepressant medication. And I did a PET scan just because the surgeon thought this could be hepatobiliary or pancreas. I don't know why he came with that idea. It was negative in that area. On Wednesday, I started her on carboplatin and Taxotere, AUC05 and 75 milligram per meter square. Because I irradiated a lot of her spine, yesterday she took Neulasta, and I started her on Zometa because of the multiple bone lesions. I did not want to start Avastin the first cycle because I've given her so many drugs at the same time. She has the incision in the scalp, although it's not a large one. She had a port, but I will definitely be adding Avastin the second cycle.
What's your experience, Dr. Hussain, been with in terms of reimbursement for Avastin in lung and colon and breast, for that matter?
Yeah. In colon, we don't have a lot of problems at all. In breast, we had a couple of patients treated, but a couple of patients denied. We are trying to get actually 3 studies Avastin in breast because probably that's the only way we are going to be able to get it in breast. The reason is insurance companies are very concerned we are going to be using Avastin and Herceptin, and they cannot even pay for one. Therefore, they are worried about the second one. In lung, I've treated, this is the 3rd patient I will be considering for Avastin. The first one, insurance paid. The second one did not, but the family paid for it, actually. But that patient didn't do very well. She progressed so fast. 3B pleural effusion around 5 months ago, within 3 to 4 months, unfortunately, she passed away around 2 weeks ago. This patient, we have not submitted her the application yet.
Ed, what are your thoughts about this patient at this point?
Yeah, I think you're doing everything you can, and that's the important thing. The biggest concern I always have when I see a patient like this is, We look for prognostic factors. We look for everything. And the bottom line is that if someone is losing weight or their performance status is on even a slight decline going into therapy, their chances of coming out of that therapy good are very low. And that's why it's almost better to take some time to try and optimize therapy, even though you're not treating the disease, to try and get that patient in good shape. And I agree with everything you've done. The struggle is going to be the appetite. I think the antidepressant is a very good idea. Drugs like Remeron, which have weight gain as a side effect, are also good, but they can make you sleepy as well. I tell patients, just as you talk about smoking status late, the first things I talk about to patients are, you have to keep your activity up, and you have to keep your weight on. It doesn't matter if I have 15 or 20 drugs for lung cancer. If you do not do these two things, you are not going to get a lot of therapy, because if you progressively lose weight, you will have difficulty getting your next round of therapy.
I'm curious, you know, it's interesting because the community docs here treat a wider spectrum of tumors than you guys do, at least at this point. I'm curious, Steve, as you look across your practice, do you see is weight loss more of an issue with the lung cancer patients than some of the other patients?
No, clearly the patients with gastrointestinal malignancies, I think far and away, that and the gynecologic malignancies, the advanced ovarian cancers and uterine cancers, the intra-abdominal diseases have much more problems with weight loss than the lung cancer patients. But I agree, it usually goes hand in hand with the performance status. Usually the people that are losing weight are also the people whose performance status is declining.
Leonard, can you present your case?
This is a 79-year-old white female, is an ex-smoker. For some reason, had a chest x-ray that identified a lesion in her right upper lobe. She had a CT of the chest and abdomen that revealed kind of a vague infiltrative lesion in the right upper lobe and also evidence of metastasis in the adrenal and liver. She had a PET scan. That right upper lobe lesion was hypermetabolic with an SUV of 8.9. Of the lesions in the liver and left adrenal gland also were abnormal on the PET scan. She had fiber optic bronchoscopy and was noted to have a poorly differentiated non-small cell lung cancer. I don't think they gave a precise histologic type. It was interesting. She also had a 2-centimeter left axillary node, and that, which was actually contralateral because the main lesion was in the right upper lobe of the lung. That was biopsied, and that was an adenocarcinoma, and it was consistent with the brushings obtained on the bronchoscopy. Patient's performance status was an ECOG 2. She had a significant past history. She was hypertensive. She had renal insufficiency with a creatinine of 2.2, non-insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, and a myocardial infarction. So basically, this was a 79-year-old patient, multiple comorbid illnesses, ECOG 2, with widespread metastatic disease.
And that's why we presented her to discuss. Now, do you think she was having symptoms of the tumor?
No.
And can you talk a little bit more about her functional status and how she spent her time?
I think she lived in assisted living. She was ambulatory, but required some assistance with her ADLs, I mean, housekeeper, et cetera. She understood in some way that she had an advanced malignancy. She clearly wanted it to be treated. She, you know, realized it was incurable, but wanted to have her life extended if possible.
And were you interacting with any family members?
No, I don't think there were any family members.
So, Ed, can you talk about how you think this went through?
Well, you've got an older female, smoker, many comorbidities, PS of 2. Sort of related to what we were talking about in the previous case is that performance status and overall clinical health is a very important factor on how aggressive we can treat these types of patients. Her advanced age makes it difficult to even consider a doublet chemotherapy, and which I would not, even with her performance status aside. There are several options we can do. One is you could definitely talk about hospice. You have to mention hospice to patients as an option. It may not be the right option at this time, but it certainly has to be something that they've heard. The second aspect is that we have oral drugs now, such as Tarceva, which have fewer side effects, and patients can generally tolerate those. Although in a first-line setting, it's unclear what the overall benefit is. There's probably some, but it's untested. You also have chemotherapy, such as Alimta, as well as weekly Taxotere, which are certainly options to poorer performance status patients. And they have done elderly studies with these drugs and are being tested in poor performance status patients with that. So those are the things that I consider when I hear this type of case. Certainly her disease is everywhere. Her outcome is not going to be very good. It's going to be hard to manage her diabetes, especially with some of the chemos as they require steroids.
Before I ask Roy about this, Ed, what do you think you maybe likely would do with a patient like this or recommend?
I would probably start her on Tarceva as the single agent choice of right now.
Roy?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the most you can do here is symptom control, supportive care, and no treatment is clearly a reasonable choice here. But this is a case where frontline Tarceva, I think, serves a good purpose. It's easy to give, generally well tolerated. Patient can take it at home, and you give the patient a trial for a couple of months and see how she does, and I think that that's a very reasonable way to go.
Can you follow up with what happened?
Yeah, I should backtrack a little. Even though her ECOG performance was 2, that was more or less her baseline status from her other comorbidities. She wasn't losing weight, and as it related to the lung cancer, she was basically asymptomatic. It was just picked up on this abnormal chest x-ray. So I wrestled with Tarceva, but gave her single-agent Taxotere. I've actually found that these elderly patients do better on every 3-week Taxotere with Neulasta. So I gave her 75 per meter squared. She's just getting her second cycle now. She handled the first cycle fine, too early to tell how she's doing.
You mentioned the issue of whether or not there's symptoms from the tumor. Ed, what about the patient whose performance status decline is because of the tumor?
Yeah, that's a very, again, gray area. We want to try and treat our patients aggressively. They come to see us for that, and we want to be able to offer them something. And that is very similar to the case that Dr. Hussein presented, where you have certain comorbidities that are affecting your everyday performance status. I try to reverse everything reversible up front. So if it's appetite or depression or pain, these are the things we work on first. The hardest situation in a patient with that type of example is one who presents with spinal cord compression. And so they have to have a neurosurgical procedure or radiation done there. It's hard for them to get back up and start walking right away. And so their performance status never really gets back to where they were prior to that lesion. And it's all a location issue with that standpoint. So very important to do those things. And then if they settle down and you notice improvements once the symptoms have been controlled, then you can treat them with standard therapy.
Roy, same 79-year-old patient, except no comorbidities, a healthy 79-year-old patient prior to developing lung cancer, now has major compromise of performance status because of the tumor.
Right, that's a very interesting distinction you make, and I do consider that. If in fact the tumor is causing the performance status decrease and you believe you have effective therapy for the tumor, that is a case where I might want to be a bit more aggressive, because then, you know, potentially you could help the tumor and help the symptoms at the same time. And, you know, that's talked about, and that might lead me in this case to go more towards a cytotoxic chemotherapy up front and maybe even try to get a platinum in if, in fact, the patient could tolerate it. Again, the short-term goal being to try to treat this tumor if I truly believe that treating that tumor would make this patient feel better. But that's a very tough road to travel, of course.
Would you start with a doublet or single-agent chemo?
Well, it's hard if someone's truly PS2 to give a platinum doublet, so I probably would give a single agent, and I think it could either be docetaxel or Alimta.
And then if you got a tumor response and the symptoms improved, the performance status improved, would you add in a platinum agent?
You know, that's an interesting thought. I think one would certainly want to consider that if, in fact, that did happen. It's not that often that it does, but if it does, you know, you have to treat these tumors aggressively.
Ed?
The one thing we have not mentioned in this case is the addition of Avastin in this patient as a doublet. And again, low side effects. She does have a questionable heart cardiovascular history, which maybe you could justify as a contraindication. Some baseline renal insufficiency. Again, we don't necessarily use that as an exclusion criteria, but you have to follow the protein to see if it gets worse, because you can't have renal insufficiency. But, you know, maybe a Taxotere Avastin frontline doublet might be reasonable. I don't know.
That's an interesting thought, Leonard. If you could get Avastin for this lady paid for, would you add it into the Taxotere?
It's a tough question with the comorbidities. I probably wouldn't.
Roy?
No, I do agree that these are all combinations of single-agent chemotherapy with the biologics, especially Avastin, need to be looked at, but I don't think I'd do it off indication here.
Okay, I'd like to go into Steve's case.
This is an 82-year-old white male who presented with painless right supraclavicular lymphadenopathy.
How did he find out about it?
He was in the shower and felt a lump. So he went to his internist and was referred to a surgeon, and the biopsy was performed, an excisional biopsy, and it revealed a neuroendocrine carcinoma. Epithelial markers were negative. It was positive for chromogranin A, and the slides were actually submitted for outside review, which confirmed the diagnosis. It was felt to be consistent with a small cell lung carcinoma.
What kind of workup was done?
Patient had CT scans of the neck, chest, and abdomen, and pelvis, all of which were negative for anything outside of the right supraclavicular region. Because of the location, the patient also was evaluated by ENT and underwent a triple endoscopy, which failed to reveal any lesion on any of the three endoscopies performed.
You said he was 82. What kind of condition was he in? Comorbidities, lifestyle?
Gentleman was generally healthy. He had chronic atrial fibrillation, for which he was on Coumadin therapy for many years and controlled with a beta blocker along with the Coumadin. The patient otherwise had no significant past medical history and was active, was married and going out with his wife, and wasn't an athlete or doing a lot of physical exertion, but was able to go out and do all the normal daily activities.
What was his attitude about this? Was he more concerned about the cancer or the treatment?
Equally concerned. He was concerned about where this came from. There was obviously some concern as to, you know, what this cancer really represented and where did it come from. And obviously, the more procedures he went through and failed to identify a primary source, the more concerned he was. And obviously was a bit concerned about the treatment. Actually, he was more concerned about the radiation than the chemotherapy.
Did you mention his smoking status?
He was an ex-smoker who had quit over 30 years ago. Prior to that, had smoked about one pack per day for about 40 years.
Ed, how would you think this through?
So he only has a right supraclavicular lymph node, nothing else.
Correct. The scans are all negative. We did not do PET scanning. It's not clear whether there's any benefit to that, and it's not covered by insurance for a small cell lung cancer.
And the node's still there, or they took it out?
The node was excised.
Completely excised. Okay, so he's NED.
Correct.
So you have a situation where clearly you have you would almost call it an unknown primary right now, although if you're calling it small cell, you have to assume it's coming, well, it could be coming from many places. Small cells can originate in many areas. Maybe you could code the PET scan as a lung cancer and then get that done, because I do know that is a problem with PET scanning, in that if you do have a diagnosis of small cell, it is not covered for some very unusual reason through reimbursement. But if it's lung cancer not otherwise specified, it is covered. So that's strategy number one. When you have patients like this, there are several ways to approach them. If it is small cell, you can have a discussion with the patient to say, look, we can consider this a local type of situation in that you have no disease that we can see that's present. Giving you chemotherapy, it would almost be in a prophylactic sense. We don't know what we're treating. We wouldn't know how many cycles to give. If you gave concurrent to the entire field, you would be adding so much excessive toxicity here and not really knowing, again, if you missed an extra pleural or extra thoracic primary on this small cell. I would have much discussions with my colleagues about this case. It might be that just radiation alone to the actual site of excision might be the only thing needed at this point. Or you could watch and wait with very close follow-up with scans to see if a primary would manifest itself. But clearly, there are situations like this where tumors are removed. I had a patient, very similar situation, who had a subcutaneous abdominal nodule that was removed, excised, and it turned out to be non-small cell lung cancer with no obvious primary. Again, a problem there. We observed her for over a year without any indication of a primary coming up, without any additional therapy.
Bottom line, what do you think most likely you'd be doing?
I think I would probably send them to radiation to see if they wanted to consolidate radiation to the actual area where the tumor was, and then just watch them very closely.
How about if instead of being 82, he was 62?
Again, I would probably do very similar aspects without any type of objective tumor in the chest to call this a lung primary or even identifying any disease. I think it's always hardest not to treat. And we like to overtreat in curative settings. But again, I think I would probably hold off and just follow him very closely.
Roy?
Well, this is a very tough case. It's the kind that usually gets transferred into MD Anderson right before a weekend. But this is a situation where clearly, you know, most of the time when small cell lung cancer is on the pathologic diagnosis, they send it to a lung cancer. It's assumed to be lung cancer. But I'm not so sure this is. Clearly, it's extensive disease from wherever it came from. And, you know, a search for primary site, you know, within reasonable limits has not yielded much. This is one where I'd sit down with a pathologist and I'd really carefully look at the pathology, and I'm sure you've done that. And if their best diagnosis is small cell, I think one can do a number of different things here. This is an elderly gentleman, but it sounds like his performance status is reasonable. It is extensive disease, primary unknown. I probably would opt for some chemotherapy here. Probably 3 or 4 cycles of chemotherapy, probably with, in his case, carboplatin, and probably use etoposide. And I'd probably do that, but discuss with him that, you know, we don't really know the primary, but this should cover, you know, most primary sites. Back off if he develops significant toxicity, and probably, you know, see how we do with that. But it's very difficult. I've had a couple of recent cases like this. One came in, it was actually interesting, actually over the holidays on call, a patient with presumed small cell lung cancer with disease throughout his body came into MD Anderson because of cord compression, but the fellow had never smoked. So, you know, that was sort of one ringer. You rarely will see small cell lung cancer in someone who hasn't smoked, and usually they're people who are continuing to smoke. But actually that patient ended up having a small bowel primary. I have several patients I've treated over the years who primary has never been noted in that way. As far as radiation, you know, that certainly could be done, but if it was a good surgical resection, this is presumably a systemic disease. So I would just differ with that a little bit, and I'd probably go more towards systemic therapy.
So that's interesting. So this patient goes to MD Anderson for a second opinion. Depends on which office he goes into. He's either going to get radiation. No,
it doesn't. Because even at MD Anderson, this is one that would go to the multimodality conference. And that's, you know, I'm sure most hospitals are doing this now. It's the only way to really make the best diagnosis. You need your pathologist there. You need the radiation oncologist. You need a group opinion. And consensus often takes a while. But I think there are a number of ways to approach this. Everything that was discussed here, I think, is reasonable. I'd be interested to know what you did.
Are you saying that all your new lung cancer patients get presented at this multimodality conference?
Well, cases, you know, in a busy practice like Anderson, where we're seeing so close to 1,000 new lung cancer patients last year, many patients will come in with metastatic disease, either frontline setting, clearly metastatic disease, or second, third line or more. Those cases, for the most part, are not discussed unless, you know, the physician has a concern, and certainly protocols are discussed in other settings. But any case that might involve, you know, more than one service, it certainly helps to have, you know, in a large center where you have a large number of radiation oncologists, surgeons, and medical oncologists, and other providers, it's nice to discuss those cases, you know, quickly, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a case, and we try to do that as best we can. I think that in this case, sometimes, you know, there are multiple options and they can get presented onto the patient. You know, that's medicine. I think it could vary from doing nothing, as has been said, to radiating, to giving chemotherapy. You have to see the patient. The person that ultimately makes the decision is the treating physician. You know, as with anything else, you have to actually see this man in the office, you know, sure, to make that decision.
So, Steve, what happened?
We did have the pathology review, and it confirmed that the pathologic diagnosis. He actually was presented at our local hospital tumor board. And he actually, on exam, there was still some residual, it was unclear if it was just induration from the biopsy or whether there was still a residual mass there. So we elected to treat him with combined modality therapy with etoposide and carboplatin, along with just involved field radiation to the supraclave area and the adjacent anterior cervical lymph nodes. Did not do any radiation to the lung area. So he received chemotherapy along with the radiation and 2 additional cycles of etoposide carboplatin after the radiation was completed. And he did beautifully. He had just some minor radiation dermatitis, sailed through the radiation without any difficulties, completed his course of chemotherapy, resumed all his normal activities, and he's now actually 1 year out. I just saw him last week, and he's over a year out and in complete remission as of this point, and still no primary site.
Ed?
Yeah, so you always ask yourself, what's the worst-case scenario that can happen and the best-case scenario? Well, the best-case scenario is that you give him the full 9 yards of treatment, which you guys did. I mean, short of giving chest, you know, prophylaxis. But again, that was probably going to be overkill. Or, you know, PCI, which, again, we don't want to go there today. And that he gets through the therapy well. But the worst-case scenario is that when you treat, is that he dies of complications from chemotherapy. And then it comes up where on a chart review that you were treating someone with chemotherapy who had no disease present. The other scenario is when you don't treat someone and you observe them, they develop widely metastatic disease and maybe disease that is so rampant and fast, which small cell can do, is that you've lost your window to treat them at all. And so that's really the 2 factors that you end up weighing. And I can already hear the voices of some of the people in our department arguing one side for chemo and the other side for not doing anything. And I know Roy is hearing these same echoes too. What's also nice is you mentioned multidisciplinary conference, Neil, is that, you know, when even in Anderson, when we're in the clinics, there are 2 or 3 medical oncologists usually there. And across the hall, there's usually 2 radiation oncologists and 2 surgeons. And so we often have our own mini multidisciplinary conferences as well, consulting with our colleagues on this. And because nobody has the right answer on any of this.